and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the new national security strategy President Trump outlined today based on four pillars: protecting the homeland, promoting American prosperity, demonstrating peace through strength, and advancing American influence. Without mentioning human rights or climate change, he did label Russia and China as rival powers, but pledged to attempt to build a great partnership with them. Brian Katulis, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia, joins us to discuss Trump's criticism of his predecessors, who he claimed drifted and lost sight of America's destiny, while he proudly proclaimed that, quote, America is coming back and America is coming back strong. Then, with the possibility that Trump will soon fire the special counsel Mueller looming, we will speak with Lisa Gilbert, the Vice President for Legislative Affairs at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She joins us to discuss a coalition that is formed with Public Citizen and dozens of other organizations who are encouraging concerned citizens to register at a new website, TrumpIsNotAboveTheLaw.org, in anticipation of a constitutional crisis erupting and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Americans protesting nationwide. Then finally, we'll examine the deadly Amtrak train derailment south of Seattle, in which rail cars plunged off a bridge over an interstate highway jammed with traffic. George Bible, a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of North Dakota and author of Train Wreck: The Forensics of Rail Disasters, joins us to discuss the derailment of the inaugural run of a new Amtrak high-speed train service to Portland and why the train was traveling at 81 miles per hour on a curve. And joining us now is Brian Katulis, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He has served on projects in more than two dozen countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt. And from 1995 to 1998, he lived and worked in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Egypt for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs. An Arabic speaker, he is the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Katulis. And what did you make of President Trump's new national security strategy that he outlined today? It was based on four pillars: protecting the homeland, promoting American prosperity, demonstrating peace through strength, and advancing American influence. He was critical of his predecessors, claiming they had drifted and lost sight of America's destiny, while he proudly proclaimed that America is coming back and America is coming back strong. Were you impressed?
Not so much, because there's nothing really new there. President Trump has had a simple narrative for the past few years, from the time that he was a candidate to now, which is that foreigners have taken advantage of America and that he's going to put America first. So that's the rhetoric. The reality is actually quite different. And I travel overseas maybe once or twice a month and talk to leaders all around the world. And I think what they see in America right now is a president that is much more erratic, inconsistent. Some see a man who's easily flattered, so they've flattered him and in many ways played them like a fiddle. When I go to places like Saudi Arabia or China, I think they're quite pleased with the type of leadership they see in President Trump, and it's one that easily complies with their wishes. So this strategy, I don't think, you know, voices a lot of the same themes we heard from President Trump. The document articulates this, but I don't think there's anything new from him. And what I see in the real world is a number of countries just sort of discounting America as a role and a factor in a lot of their calculations.
Well, is there any understanding of whether Donald Trump has a grasp on the enormous inconsistencies in his claims and his actions? I mean, when he talks about making America great again and strong and taking on China, who were cheating and all the stuff that he went on about in the election campaign, the first thing he did was to get rid of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a way to organize the neighborhood to force China to play by the rules. And in getting rid of that, you know, it was a fairly as much a political document as an economic document and a strategy document. And in getting rid of it, he's given China a free pass. And he's claiming, as he did today, that the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord and the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal are among his great successes in office. So what is this? He's just basically calling a defeat a victory and assuming that we're all going to swallow it?
Yes, I think so. And, you know, when it comes to the issue of trade, the more that America sits passively on the sidelines in trade negotiations, the more U.S. companies and exporters will face disadvantages and discrimination in global commerce. So what we've seen from President Trump and his team is a lot of bluster, but in effect, it has basically surrendered the playing field to a number of emerging powers like China. I'd add to it, I think the really interesting and more important story this week, quite frankly, more important than his strategy document, which we'll talk about maybe for a day or so, and he may undo with a tweet or two. He could at a moment's notice. The more important story is his tax plan, you know, and the plan that's sitting before Congress. And that, in many ways, I think is much more important because it's a recipe for not only driving up America's debt and deficits and increasing income inequality at home, it's going to actually reduce our competitiveness. Yes, corporate tax rates are going down, but so will investment in basic security and safety, in public investments, in things like infrastructure and our railway system. And these sorts of things will just have fewer investments. So to me, the strategy in and of itself, as most of these strategies go, will be a story probably for a day or two. The longer-term damage, I think, that may be done this week is what the Republican Party, which is effectively owned by the Trump administration now, in going forward with this tax plan, will actually undermine America's ability to compete in the world economically and in other spheres like climate change, as you mentioned.
So in labeling Russia and China as rival powers, he also pledged to try and build a great partnership with them. There was some criticism of Russia, which is surprising coming from Donald Trump, who's been nothing but a huge fan of Vladimir Putin's. But he did at least mention cybersecurity in relation to the Russians. But that flies in the face of what we just learned from a very extensive Washington Post investigation about the National Security Council and how it operates. And apparently the Russia people on the National Security Council, Fiona Hill being the leader, they have absolutely no communications with him. He doesn't want anything to do with them. And he gets so crazy when anybody mentions anything about Russia, he takes it personally as though they're bringing up the election results and trying to delegitimize him. And apparently it's gotten so bad that the presidential daily briefing, that the CIA briefers don't even mention Russia in the briefing, which he's likely to fly off the handle. So if Russia were to covertly send its little green man into Estonia, for example, the CIA apparently aren't able to tell him what's going on in the real world. So I think, isn't that really where our focus should be? Not on a speech, but on the behavior of our commander-in-chief and president in terms of foreign policy?
Oh, absolutely. And I've been following these strategies since essentially President Bill Clinton put one out back in the 1990s, and we've had many of these strategies, and what you just said is the key point with every president, which is don't evaluate this document like you'll see academics and we in the think tank community do based on its text. Evaluate it on what a president does and what this president does specifically. And I guess what I would say is coming to close to the end of the first year of Trump's time in office, it's really hard to point to any clear success where America has actually gained an advantage on its own. We've moved forward in the fight against ISIS, which I think is very important, but that was really laid into place by the Obama administration, and our military moved forward with it. When it comes to Russia and the point you raised, what we've seen under President Trump is an alarming passivity to the threat that Russia has posed and continues to pose, quite frankly, to the U.S. What was interesting about that Washington Post report you mentioned that was out late last week, I think it's noted by many experts that Russia continues to try to interfere with U.S. elections and domestic politics. It's not just an issue from 2016. It's also an issue beyond America we see in European elections. And the fact that our president of the United States seems to want to put his fingers in his ear and not hear it it exposes us in a world where Russia has used this, its own power to try to punch above its weight and put America and other countries back on its heels and divide us. And it's alarming that this man is our commander-in-chief.
So given that there is this peculiar relationship with Putin and Russia, and Putin just called up Trump and congratulated him on the state of the U.S. stock exchange, and then Trump in turn called up Putin and apparently tipped him off about, gave him some CIA information. The very agency that he trashes all the time, the CIA, gave them the Russians some CIA information that prevented a terrorist attack in St. Petersburg, for which Putin was grateful. But if Trump closes down the Mueller investigation, which there's rumors that he may do it as early as this coming Friday, fire Mueller, fire Rosenstein, over the Russia investigation, which the Fox News propagandists are laying the groundwork for that on a daily basis. They're beating the hell out of that story, or that manufactured story, I should say. How will that impact this international perspective on this man? Because if I were a Russian and it became clear that the President of the United States has some kind of relationship with Putin to the extent that the Russian leader seems to own the American president, if you're a European, you got Putin on the east and you don't have the Americans on the west, you know, having your back, which has been what NATO's been about for the longest time, they got to be feeling pretty anxious.
Yeah, and they've been feeling pretty anxious for a while, in large part because Russia, when it invaded Ukrainian territory under President Obama, did so with, you know, very tepid reaction. I mean, we had sanctions against Russia, but there wasn't any strong counter move. And, you know, my main point is that, yes, President Trump is a weak leader on this front, but America has not been the strongest of partners to our friends in Europe for a long while. There, in essence, has been this crisis of purpose about American leadership. And I think Trump emerges from that, in essence, because Americans were, you know, raising questions about what is it we're doing overseas, why should we care about all of these instances, and I think Trump feeds into that. When I go to Europe, there's grave concern about President Trump right now because of the multiple messages that come out of his own mouth, let alone the conflicting messages from his overall administration. And the main question they have is America still with us as we were during the Cold War? And I think what President Trump tries to do today in his strategy is paint Russia and China somewhat closer in terms of a Cold War mindset. That's what the document does. But don't look at what the document does. Look at what his administration and he does. And it's quite passive. It's allowing countries like Russia to intimidate some of their neighbors and some of our allies in NATO. And this is all at a time when President Trump has actually been very critical of NATO allies for not doing their share and pulling their weight. All of that, I think, just undermines their confidence in America's ability to lead.
Well, in terms of America's ability to lead, it was a bit embarrassing on the UN Security Council where the U.S. had to veto a resolution from Egypt trying to reverse the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That completely isolated the U.S. All 14 voted for the resolution. Egypt is some kind of an ally. What did you make of that?
Well, it's not terribly surprising because, look, I've lived in the Middle East for a long while, as you mentioned, and I go back regularly. And this reaction should not have been a surprise to anyone. It's interesting that this isolation of America at the UN Security Council comes on the same day as President Trump's touting our leadership. And quite frankly, I mean, some of our most pragmatic and closest allies in the Middle East, Egypt, Jordan, countries that have peace with Israel, have strenuously objected to this move by Trump, in large part because it's not connected to anything at all, right? It's just a gesture, and it seems like a move to please part of Trump's domestic political base, conservative voters, some evangelical Christians who voted for him. But when I talk to people who have been trying to plant the foundations for our progress on the peace process inside of the U.S. government, they strenuously objected to this move as well. So this vote, I think, you know, in many ways symbolizes the gap between Trump's rhetoric, which is what we heard in the speech and we can see in his document on national security today, and the reality, which is an America that is increasingly isolated and actually having squandered a lot of its influence, because we've got a great deal of influence with some of our partners in the Middle East, but some of these closest and more pragmatic partners that already have peace with Israel are condemning this move that Trump made earlier this month on Jerusalem.
Right, but doesn't that lead to the conclusion, particularly if, as you just said, Trump made that unusual, unexpected, and completely counterproductive move, which goes against decades of U.S. foreign policy, to essentially please the so-called Christian Zionist wing of the evangelicals, and that apparently had a lot to do with the close race in Alabama. So if the President of the United States is willing to throw his lot in with a child molester and completely disrupt U.S. foreign policy in order to win over a few more votes, I don't think there's ever been an example of that in the stewardship of U.S. foreign policy, where for petty domestic electoral reasons, a president would wreck the architecture of U.S. foreign policy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you and your point. But one point I'd add to it is that Trump is a consequence of a number of political leaders trying to score petty partisan political points on national security. It's something that I think has happened essentially since the 2002 midterm elections after the 9/11 attacks. If you remember in those elections, and then when George W. Bush and John Kerry fought it out in the presidential elections, Republicans essentially said, if you vote for Democrats, you're voting for terrorists. That's close to a quote of what President Bush said. So we've had this hyper-partisanship on national security, and it cuts both ways. Democrats, similarly, I think, have tried to use security as a wedge issue, unlike we've ever seen before in our nation's history. And it's in this space where I think a lot of Americans simply have tuned it out, right? And they were concerned, especially after the economic recession in 2008, 2009, and trying to claw it back. This is where I think Trump steps into that breach. He's a consequence of, and he's the latest example, of many politicians trying to use national security, which should be something that unifies us as Americans, politicians have been using this for years as a wedge issue. And that is, I think, undermined political support for anything that we might do in the world that requires unity and national purpose.
Well, Brian Katulis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Brian Katulis, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on U.S. national security policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He has served on projects in more than two dozen countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt. And from 1995 to 1998, he lived and worked in the West Bank and Gaza Strip and Egypt for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs, an Arabic speaker. He is the co-author of The Prosperity Agenda. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the coalition that has formed to encourage concerned citizens to register at a new website, TrumpIsNotAboveTheLaw.org, in anticipation of him firing Robert Mueller.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? After invasion, this means war. This means war. Someday.
It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. It's time to get away. It's time to get away from you. You brought a lot of money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lisa Gilbert, who's the Vice President of Legislative Affairs at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She is a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and Think Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Gilbert.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm hearing rumors, Lisa, that President Trump could fire Robert Mueller as early as this coming Friday. What are you hearing there in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I think we're all hearing similar rumors that a firing is possible at any point. I wouldn't say that we know a specific date, but certainly we're on high alert. Regardless of what President Trump says about his intentions, we know he can change on a dime, and we also know that the attacks from the right-wing pundits and other surrogates for Mr. Trump have been coming fast and furious. And so, you know, regardless of kind of good cop, bad cop, we still want to be prepared for the worst.
Well, it's clearly an orchestrated campaign underway led by Fox News and, I suppose, to a lesser extent, Breitbart, to really vilify the special counsel. I mean, that judge on Fox has just gone completely off the charts with the most poisonous attacks on him. To me, that doesn't seem random. That seems more orchestrated than random.
I couldn't agree more. I think when you start seeing something in many outlets all at the same time, it's planned. And it's a little reminiscent of Watergate, conservative attacks in a coordinated way to try to either prematurely end the special counsel investigation or just discredit it.
So tell us about the organization or the coalition that you're a part of, along with a lot of groups, including the Truman National Security Project, MoveOn.org, Civic Action, and of course Public Citizen, which is you, Stand Up for America, March of Truth, Common Cause, Indivisible, People for the American Way, Democracy 21, and the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Tell us about this coalition that you formed with all of those groups that I mentioned and more, TrumpIsNotAboveTheLaw.org.
Yes, well, that website you just referenced is an organizing project that the groups you mentioned are a part of, as, along with many others. So it's more than 50 organizations that have come together. It's, you know, cross-partisan, you know, different ideologies, but all focused on the same thing, which is that, you know, we believe that, you know, there is no one who is above the law, including the president, and the Mueller investigation is critical to understand what happened in 2016 and to understand if there was any collusion or any obstruction of justice since then, and the investigation needs to be protected. And TrumpIsNotAboveTheLaw.org is a website where people can engage and sign up to do things.
So I take it that you and all these other partners in this coalition, these organizations that I just mentioned, they share the concern that Donald Trump could fire Robert Mueller at any moment?
I think there's a real fear that something will be done to undercut the investigation, whether it's as far as a straightforward firing, which would, of course, require him to first fire Rosenstein, the acting or the deputy AG who has charge of the investigation and is over Mueller. But whether he begins that Saturday Night Massacre litany or not, there are lots of other things that are happening to undercut it. You know, we are worried that, you know, pardons will come for people who are indicted. We're concerned that there'll continue to be attacks on the credibility of the investigation. And so I think we're aligned in both trying to protect it and then preparing in the event that, that a Mueller firing actually happens.
Well, obviously, getting rid of Rod Rosenstein is the first axe to fall, and then he would put somebody in there that would fire Mueller, right? Is that the
Yep, that's exactly right. Because Attorney General Sessions recused himself from work on the investigation, Rod Rosenstein oversees Mueller. He would either have to agree to fire him, and if he wouldn't, be fired himself, and then Trump would find someone who would take that role and fire Mueller.
Well, already there have been some people eased out at DOJ, have they not? I mean, what I sense in this orchestrated campaign that Fox is leading, it's not just an attack on Mueller, but it's also an attack on the FBI and suggesting that the Justice Department's not doing its job. I think mm-hmm. they've moved some people, haven't they, into dead-end jobs already?
Yes. I mean, I think you're referring to actually one of the attacks on the investigation is that one of the FBI agents shared some texts where he was pro-Hillary Clinton, and you know Mueller and others moved him, you know, into a different part of the FBI, no longer part of the or a different part of the DOJ, no longer part of the investigation. You know, that's something that's important because it shows that Robert Mueller is running a tight ship, that there's no one who is conflicted, who's part of the investigation.
Well, it does seem that another precursor to, you know, another domino that would fall before the axe would fall on Mueller is the congressional committees. That's pretty much been achieved, has it not, by Trump's and his surrogates like Devin Nunes, the former chair of the House Intelligence Committee. They've basically crippled that committee, have they not? I mean, it just seems like you just see photo ops with Representative Schiff complaining about things, but they're not getting anything done. So could you declare them already dead on arrival, the House Intelligence Committee?
Well, I mean, I hope that's not where we land, but we certainly see the same writing on the wall that you do. You know, it has seemed like they've floundered, and we haven't seen the hard hitting interviews, and certainly not yet a transparent report on what they've found that shows us that they've taken this seriously. You know, as you say, Adam Schiff has taken to the airwaves to talk about that quite a bit because it is a real problem. You know, and certainly we hope that the intel investigation in both chambers, as well as what the Judiciary Committees are doing, continues full steam because it is another avenue for getting to the bottom of what happened when the Russians interfered in our elections, which we have to understand because we're rapidly approaching our next election.
Well, we saw a preview, did we not, of the kind of attacks on Rosenstein when he testified just recently. Some of the Tea Party Freedom Caucus people were really quite rabid in their attacks on him. And again, there's no substance to what they're saying, but they keep hammering away at it. And I was interested or very much struck by what Trump said the other day in the Rose Garden on his way to the helicopter, just saying, you know, people are really upset about the FBI and the DOJ and this whole Russia investigation. You know, he keeps calling it a hoax. People are really upset. Well, the people that are really upset are the ones that watch Fox News. And the reason they're upset is that Fox News is baking all this stuff up about what a terrible guy Mueller is. You know, this is the Vietnam War hero, highly decorated Republican, former head of the FBI, always right. considered to be an incredibly upstanding public servant, and now he's the devil incarnate. So that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? Where, you know, you basically create a phony controversy and then you start quoting that as being a reason why you might have to remove this guy because a lot of people are upset by the very yep. people who are making up this whole attack. I find it just absolutely amazing.
It is pretty amazing. I think that there you can just trace back the respect for Mueller to the numerous quotes from members of the Republican Party when he was first chosen to run the investigation, you know, ranging from Mitch McConnell to Speaker Ryan to many members of the caucus to, you know, Newt Gingrich and those outside of the halls of Congress right now. Everybody saying what you just said, that, you know, he's a guy whose career is unimpeachable. It's been an extraordinary time watching him be a public servant. And so it is pretty appalling to see that narrative turned on its head with spurious conflicts, rumors, and mud smearing. And so I think it's very important that people remember what Mueller has done for the country and what he's doing now. But beyond that, just how important it is to protect the integrity of the investigation, because they're doing all the smearing because they are worried by what he will find.
Well, but the same thing's happening where they've ginned up this phony controversy over the GSA giving Mueller all of these emails from the Trump transition team. And that's a complete storm in a teacup. There's nothing improper, unusual about prosecutors getting evidence from third parties. Yet they're going to town on that too. It just seems like an extension of the same tactic.
That's completely right. And in a rare public comment, as I'm sure you've seen, a spokesman for Mueller denied the accusations by Trump transition lawyers that they somehow got these emails in an unauthorized way. He was very clear that, you know, they only obtain emails in the appropriate manner with the account owner's consent, you know, according to the criminal processes that are appropriate. And, you know, I think they stand on completely firm ground. And as you say, it is once again kind of just throwing anything out there that people think might stick so that they can in turn accuse the investigation of acting improperly and discredit what the findings are.
So what do you expect it will happen with the meeting between, I'm not sure that Mueller himself or is it, whether it's the representatives of the special counsel's probe that we're meeting with the White House lawyers. Is that supposed to happen in the next couple of days, isn't it?
That is supposed to happen in the next couple of days. I think it's impossible to predict what the conversation will be. I know that, you know, the Trump team is, of course, trying to project that they think it'll be nothing and this will start the road to the investigation ending. I think most others would assume that because of the cooperation deals that have been struck with the folks who've already been indicted, that Mueller is probably sitting on something and he'll have things to say. But we'll all have to watch together to learn that outcome.
Right, but the thing that makes me suspicious that Trump's planning on firing Mueller is that, and this has preceded his remarks, you know, the lawyers, Ty Cobbs, have been floating this idea for the longest time, that there's some sort of artificial deadline at the end of the year that this whole thing's going to wrap up. They're the ones, the White House is making up this deadline. They are the ones that have created this end point, which has nothing to do with Mueller. So that's my suspicion, is that they're sort of creating an artificial deadline, and then they're going to say, well, he's passed the deadline, he's wasting money, we're going to close it down. How do you see that?
Yep, I think that's completely right. They attempt to discredit, then they will say it's wasting money, and then they will say we should stop appropriating funds for it. You know, I think the only thing we can do is be a step ahead of that and be putting the truth out there about the importance of what they're finding and what they may find.
Well, then let's turn to what Trump is not above the law.org, this coalition that you're a part of, Lisa Gilbert at Public Citizen, again, the Truman National Security Project, MoveOn.org, Civic Action, Stand Up for America, March for Truth, Common Cause, Indivisible, People for the American Way, Democracy 21, and the Center for American Progress Action Fund. What is the plan here to, I guess you can't stop Trump from firing Mueller, but a lot of pundits have already said this could be a constitutional crisis. It will certainly rile a lot of people up. How do you see the events unfolding if Trump is to go ahead and fire the special counsel?
Yep. I mean, I think we see an immense amount of outrage that will sweep the country if this happens. I think there are people waiting feverishly to understand the next step, you know, in what the investigation will uncover, and are appalled by the idea that it could be ended by the administration right as they're being investigated. It's pretty egregious to consider that. There's no reason to fire if you're not guilty. So that is how people are waiting with bated breath, and what they can do is sign up at the website to be a part of that moment if and when it does happen. So TrumpIsNotAboveTheLaw.org is a place to register and say you want to participate in an event within 5 hours of a Mueller firing. You can also sign up to host an event and create a new one on the map. And certainly it's a way to show that you are ready and waiting, but also to get on a list and be helpful in the interim.
So is this organization or this coalition, Trump is not above the law.org, are they making plans? Do they have strategy underway, or are they just signing up people?
So So this TrumpIsNotAboutTheLaw.org is just the website for organizing people for this moment in time. So it's not actually the name of any coalition, but just the place to go to engage. But lots of organizations care about this and have been messaging people that are part of their organization and others around the country to share this resource.
Well, the thing that worries me about Trump and Bannon and these people is that they're incredibly cynical, and they've developed a kind of media savvy, borrowed it from Putin and from Putin's so-called political technologist, Surkov, who created the kind of media atmosphere in Russia where nothing is true and everything is possible. And the idea is to sort of desensitize people to the truth, to the point where the truth doesn't matter. And arguably that was why Bannon was supporting Roy Moore, who was charged with being a child molester. Had Roy Moore won, then the idea that a child molester could get elected again feeds into that sort of sense of cynicism that everything and anything is possible and nothing really matters anymore. So you're dealing with a deeply cynical group of people. And they have obviously created a constituency in this country with, thanks to Fox News, where you've got, 35% of the people in America immune to facts and evidence. So what is your expectation about how you could harness outrage when the Trump people are trying to suggest that nothing matters anymore, you know, which... We can get away with, they're acting like the mafia. They're just acting like thugs with the expectation that power at the end will prevail and a bunch of people go out there and scream and demonstrate in the streets and it'll all fade down. And if we do it over Christmas, then by the new year, they will have forgotten it. I mean, that's the way I'm pretty sure they see it.
Yes, and I think they vastly underestimate how people are paying attention and what something of this magnitude means. You know, we're talking about criminal indictments of people in his campaign, and we're talking about the potential for severe obstruction of justice and, potential collusion with a foreign government to influence an election. So I think, you know, just the fact that we have 500 people who've signed up to host events around the country in every state and 55,000 who've signed up to participate in something that they don't even know for sure will happen, I mean, that shows a massive amount of interest. And so, you know, I think the next steps beyond the organizing moment will fall to the shoulders of Congress. You know, the next pieces will be to hold obstruction of justice hearings, to impanel a select committee like we saw in Watergate. I mean, I think the level of constitutional crisis will be extreme if what we're talking about comes to bear, and I don't think we can quite predict what it will be like because it will be so different from any scandal we've seen, at least since Nixon.
So you think that both Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell will be shamed into doing the right thing?
I think that the public outrage will make it very challenging for them not to.
Well, I could say, well, I hope this doesn't happen, but this is not your usual government, is it? This is a government that has done things that simply go against the grain, and there seems to be no limit to their cynicism. And I'm frankly expect something to happen quite soon. So I think it's time.
We shall see.
I think it's time for people to, you're saying, get organized before it happens, right?
That's what we're saying, absolutely. And I would never say that we know it will happen, but it's important to be prepared and to do everything you can to protect the investigation and then be ready, if it's no longer there, to push back.
Well, Lisa Gilbert, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Lisa Gilbert, who's the Vice President of Legislative Affairs at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. She is a contributor to the National Journal's expert blog on lobbying and ethics and writes frequently for the Huffington Post and for Think Progress. And Public Citizen is a part of a coalition that is formed in anticipation of the possibility that Trump will fire the special counsel Mueller, and people can sign up to get ready for such a constitutional crisis that will unfold. They can register themselves at TrumpIsNotAboveTheLaw.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the deadly Amtrak train derailment south of Seattle. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is George Bible, who's a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of North Dakota and the author of Trainwreck, The Forensics of Rail Disasters. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Bible.
Hello, thank you.
And George, it looks as though this train derailment and crash that rail cars toppled onto traffic on an interstate just outside of Seattle, it does seem that this was like an inaugural run for a fast-track commuter train from Seattle to Portland, and it was rounding a curve. So what do you know so far, given that this was an inaugural run, I believe, for a fast train, and it apparently was doing about 81 miles an hour, which by European standards is not that fast. But my understanding is that they made this new rail line as straight as possible, yet the crash occurred on a curve, apparently.
Well, they mostly do derail on curves because that's where you have centrifugal force trying to shove the train off the tracks normally. So if something else goes wrong, they're most likely to derail on a curve.
And in this case, what's your understanding about the new tracks themselves? I mean, to have a high-speed train, I assume you have to improve the tracks, which I believe get pretty worn down by freight traffic, don't they?
Well, I everything I hear, I think, is preliminary. I had heard this track was limited to 79 miles an hour, which is the standard speed limit for all Amtrak tracks, trains nationwide, which was actually set in 1947 after a high-speed collision. So unless they have additional safety features, 79 miles an hour is the default speed limit. And nowadays, the additional safety features is positive train control. But to get back to your question, yes, as the trains go faster, you need truer, straighter, higher geometric standards on the track so the trains don't bounce off the tracks.
And given that this is an inaugural run for what was billed as a high-speed rail, commuter rail, from Seattle to Portland, do we know whether this was a new track?
Well, I don't know. An inaugural run, in my mind, does that mean first for this train or first for this high-speed train or first for these tracks? They're all different things, so I'm not sure that's been clearly defined.
Mm-hmm. Well, the people aboard the train that weren't injured or were not so badly injured reported that it did happen on a track. And the train started to wobble, and then it just tipped. And apparently, some of the rail cars went over the trestle onto an interstate, and that's where a number of cars were crushed. I believe on the ground there weren't so many fatal injuries, which is pretty surprising, but most of the fatal injuries were actually in the rail carriages. Is that your understanding?
Yes. Surprisingly, a high-speed derailment is quite survivable. Usually what kills people is if you crush the car by derailing into something solid, or the other thing, now you can always get tossed badly and break your neck. And a 2015 accident in Philadelphia, four of the eight dead were found outside underneath the car, and there are a lot of damaged windows, so getting tossed from the train is problematic, kind of like being tossed out of your car in a car accident if you don't have your seatbelt on.
Well, but they don't have seatbelts on trains, do they?
That's correct. But if you're thrown from a car, you got a high probability of breaking your neck.
Sure, but has there been any talk of seatbelts on a train? Derailments are rare, but obviously we're talking about one today. And you mentioned the one earlier in Philadelphia that was also going too fast around a curve, wasn't it?
Yes, well, I don't know that this one is going too fast around a curve yet. That's preliminary information. Actually, they mostly derail because of broken equipment. I just looked up the number of derailments so far this year. It's 254. It's not that uncommon. Of course, these are mostly freight trains, and only three of them derailed from going too fast on a curve, so it's actually rare. But it happened in Philadelphia. It happened in Spain, 2013. They're, both cases, they're going about twice the speed limit. In Spain, they killed 59 because they had the misfortune of derailing into a massive solid concrete bridge abutment.
Well, it's apparently, and this is something I wanted to get some clarity on from you, George Bible, is that the rails that that these new train services, and this in this case this new high speed train service, they share with freight trains, right? My understanding is that Amtrak doesn't it subsidizes, it doesn't make much of a profit at all, but the rail systems, the freight systems, are the profitable part of railways in this country. Is that accurate?
Yes, the last time I looked, the only passenger trains making money are in the highly populated Northeast Corridor, where they really are running high-speed trains 120 miles an hour and even 150 miles an hour in a small portion. There seems to be a sweet spot, something like 200 to 400 miles an hour, where fast trains are more popular than flying, especially trains can go from city center to city center, and you don't have to fiddle around going to remote airports.
Well, that's in Europe and in Japan, the bullet trains. We don't have it. Well, the Acela is that one that you're referring to, I guess, on the Northeast Corridor.
Yes.
And it doesn't have a dedicated line, does it? It has to slow down every now and then. So it only reaches, 120 miles an hour in little bursts. It doesn't. It's not a sustained speed, is it?
Yes. In fact, I think it's kind of amazing. I think there's something like 140 interchanges, essentially train intersections. They have to slow down and kind of turn their way through those. And it's a big problem. The solution is to make a much bigger radius curve, and you can't do that in metropolitan areas without tearing out neighborhoods.
So what's the likelihood that we will move in this direction? I believe that the efforts here in California are to have a high-speed train that is a dedicated track that's straight, and of course it goes through the California desert, so that's not a problem, but there's been a lot of hostility towards it. The Governor Brown has tried to champion it, but the federal government has not been helpful, including local congresspeople. But now the president himself comes out today when he's talking about national security. He mentions that infrastructure is a big part of national security, and he cites this train accident as reason for the need to invest in infrastructure.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I'm an engineering professor. I'm not into the. I'm not here to talk about politics.
Well, it wasn't about. I wasn't talking about politics so much as to suggest that there is, obviously, it's controversial getting these kind of investments, even when the president calls for it today, as he did. What I understand is that the only real high-speed rail possibility in this country is the one in California, is it not? And it's not exactly taking off, it's not flying off the ground, is it?
Well, they've been studying it and continue to study it in many locations, and it always has two problems. It's extremely expensive, and eventually you're going to be building through a lot of neighborhoods, and that people are typically not happy about that.
No.
It's easier in other countries to see someone as property than seems to be the tradition in this country.
Well, as you know, as I say, the president tweeted out today, $7 trillion spent in the Middle East while our roads, bridges, tunnels, railways, and more crumble, not for long. So do you think that there will be some kind of new investment in infrastructure? I mean, I take it it's needed. In the work that you do, does infrastructure play a role in the accidents that you studied?
Well, there's wear and tear. In fact, high on the list of derailments is a broken track, roughly a third. But the rails wear out. It's something like almost 250,000 potholes every year in New York City. So it doesn't matter how much you spend, you're still going to have wear and tear issues on the rail. Now, they spend a lot of money on infrastructure, and a lot is needed. That takes in an awful lot of things, but most of the railroads tracks are privately owned and privately maintained, and I think they do a pretty good job. Now, things are going to break, but we kill 30,000-40,000 people a year in car accidents. It's just you're not going to have 100% safety no matter what you do.
But when you say the rail lines are privately owned, they're largely owned by the rail companies that haul freight, right? Not by Amtrak.
That's correct. Amtrak, I don't think owns. I don't know if they own any track. If they do, it's not a lot.
Right. So does that mean then that the freight companies that own the tracks and maintain them, basically, they take care of their business first, right? Amtrak would be second.
They want safe tracks too. So tracks or unsafe tracks are equal problem for them.
Right, but their trains don't go as fast, do they? Freight trains.
That's correct.
So, tell us about this positive train control, because I believe that there was an effort after the Philadelphia crash to institute that across the country, but that's been stalled, I think, because of Washington politics. What's your understanding?
Well, it was mandated by an act of Congress in 2008 after the crash in Los Angeles that killed 25 people, where the driver was texting. And actually, it was studied by the Federal Railroad Administration twice and rejected because it was didn't meet their standard cost-benefit analysis, but Congress passed it anyhow, as they're entitled to do after that terrible accident in 2008. And it was mandated to be complete by the end of 2016, but it was a massive technical problem, and they never made it. In fact, the train said, we're not going to operate in violation of the law. We'll park our trains if it comes to that. So Congress kind of at the last minute passed a three-year or longer extension. It kind of, they have to negotiate route by route with the FRA. So they're still working on it, and there are some, there's been lots of progress made. There are some individual lines here and there with it working, but I don't know what was the situation on this particular track with today's accident.
And what's the FRA?
The Federal Railroad Administration. They're analogous to the FAA.
Right. So they're investigating this derailment in Seattle or south of Seattle?
They'll be there too, but the National Transportation Safety Board has legal control over all transportation accidents. And they make safety recommendations, which is, they've been recommending positive train control for a number of years, but the Federal Railroad Administration actually writes the safety rules and enforces them. So there's two different government entities involved in a train wreck, the NTSB and the FRA.
And what improvements were brought about after the Philadelphia derailment? Because driver of that train was driving considerably faster, wasn't he, than that curve allowed?
Well, positive train control would have prevented that. It won't. Most train wrecks are because of derailment. Something breaks, and positive train control will not solve that problem. It will solve driving too fast on a curve. So the improvement is to implement PTC, but it's already being implemented as fast as it can, as they're able to do it.
But it wasn't. It wasn't. At play in this derailment in Seattle, right? Do we know?
Well, I don't think we know anything yet. It could be. That's the list of possibilities, but I think I mentioned earlier there are 254 derailments so far this year. Only three were too fast on a curve. Most of them are equipment failure. There are other human errors, but they usually involve handling a long freight train, which is a lot more complicated than a short passenger train.
Well, just in closing, George Bible, I know there's been an effort on the part of Amtrak to attract riders, and obviously, here in Los Angeles, there's an effort underway to get more people to take the light rail. The investments have been made, very expensive investments in it. Given it was the inaugural run, is this going to, it's not going to attract more people to taking rail, which seems to be a kind of campaign that Amtrak have been pushing for some time?
Well, these kinds of accidents obviously are not good, but travel by train is significantly safer than travel by car.
Well, George Bible, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with George Bible, who's a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of North Dakota and the author of Trainwreck, The Forensics of Rail Disasters. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.